Hey, everybody. Yeah, this is Alex Lindsay, and I'm here with Ron Brinkman and John LaBrie. Hey, Ron, how's it going?
It's going well. And good to be here.
And you're down in Santa Monica?
Down in Hermosa Beach,
Beach. And John, where are you now?
I'm in Hermosa Beach as well.
So it's like the VFX show is slowly, and I'll be down near Hermosa Beach tomorrow. So we're all slowly coalescing.
Moving to the beach.
Now, can you guys actually see the beach from your house?
If I lean out of my front door really far, I can see a little sliver of it.
If I stand on my roof and jump up and down really high, I can see a little sliver of it.
Yeah. Now, from my house, I can see the bay, but I can't see the ocean. So it's I mostly just see the bay. I don't actually ever actually touch it. Isn't that the way it is? You move somewhere where you're going to be near the water, and then you actually never get near the water.
It's all about the clean air.
It's all about the money.
Yeah, exactly.
I can't afford to see the water right now.
Yeah, exactly. So so we're back after a little bit of a hiatus, and we just came back last week. We had Seagraph, and for those of you listening that don't listen to or don't follow this as closely or haven't heard of Seagraph, it is the big graphics conference. There's basically like really two really really big conferences in the U.S. anyway. And one is, of course, NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the other is Seagraph. Seagraph has been going on for, 25 years?
25 at least, yeah.
At least 25 years. And it started off as mostly, scientists talking about how to do rendering, and it's really kind of slowly grown into a show, I think, to the chagrin of a lot of researchers, that's really become much more entertainment-based.
Although I would say that I think it's kind of gone through its peak in the commercial part and is coming back a little bit more to being having a little more research stuff. It just felt like that this year, probably partially because it was in Boston.
Yeah.
And there's such a university presence there.
Right.
And I think also being remote from LA meant that a lot of vendors didn't bother going either.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was a much smaller event than I would have.
Yeah. I kind of liked it.
Yeah, it was easy because you didn't feel like you needed 3 days just to walk. I mean, years ago, many years ago, it used to be something that you would have it would take you 2 days to get through the entire event, and it was huge, and it took almost all of the LA Convention Center, and now it's much more reasonable at this point.
I think trade shows in general are dying, personally.
Well, it's hard. I mean, the actual expo, I don't know how useful. I have to admit, I barely see the expo. I go to Seagraph because there's a bunch of people that are all showing up at the same time that I need to meet, and I'm in meetings almost all day, and I speak at a couple booths, but that's about
and the parties.
Well, I just
think that trade shows in general, it's not like it was 10 years ago where you had to go there to see what the latest stuff is. Now with the web and everything, you can stay on top of what the latest technology and announcements are a lot easier.
Yeah, I still find it, I do find it useful to be to be at some of these meetings. It is more efficient. I always say that we're going to be able to do everything globally and we'll never need to actually see each other. But there is something when you get to these things that it makes a difference to actually talk to people occasionally. I know it sounds crazy, but that interaction sometimes is important. So
I think increasingly the real value of the shows is that everybody's there. It's less to do with the vendors and possibly even, in the case of Seagraph, the papers, even though some of them are great. It's more to do with the fact that you're going to find a lot of people, birds of a feather, if you will, that are in town and catch up with people about what they're doing. And so even for like the E3 show, which died recently, and some of the other shows around the industry, it's all about the fact that that guy you need to see once a year is actually going to be in Vegas or LA or San Diego or wherever.
Right. And the key is just making sure that there's enough reason for everybody to come in, more than whether there's an expo or papers or anything else.
Yeah. Alex and you and I were talking earlier about how it's so hard to get around to on the floors these days. It's you're more likely to spend time in meetings.
Yeah, and that's, as I said, that's why I go. I mean, I set up all those meetings, and I know that everyone's going to be there. And it's almost like if we all just agreed to show up. Of course, there's the normal stuff that we would have here, which is Maya and 3D Studio released new versions. Did you see much of that? Did you see much of what was released in those two apps?
I didn't see a whole lot. For the first time in a long time, I was able to go to a lot of the classes instead of just going to the booth and that kind of stuff. Apple didn't have a booth there this year, so it was nice because I was able to go to classes and not have to hang out at the booth.
Right.
So I did a little bit of a walking through the show floor, and I sort of looked at a few interesting things, but I didn't pop by Maya at all.
Well, you know, Autodesk now has it. It's going to be curious. I mean, there's all kinds of rumors, of course, about, you know, what the future is for Macs and Maya and you know, where they're going. And it looked like, I mean, with these new releases, I know that their marketing is on full tilt, but, you know, it seemed like very incremental releases. I think it's hard for a lot of the established companies to really do anything that's profound anymore.
I mean, I think having been through similar kinds of situations, I know what it takes to try and start to integrate, you know, products from a couple different evolutionary backgrounds. I mean, I was at Wavefront back whenever the TDI merger happened, and then left there, but was still in touch with a lot of people when the Alias merger happened, and it's a lot of work.
Yeah. Yeah.
So no. Do you guys have a sense? I mean, do you have a sense of whether Maya or Max survives, or there's going to be a combined product, or one of them's going to be seeing the end of life?
Well, you know, there's of course lots of rumors that are floating around. I mean, there's the most normalized one. I mean, the most regular rumor that, I mean, everyone's been talking about is that they're going to really still focus on Maya being, you know, more towards film, and Max really owning a lot of the game area. There are rumors that what may happen is they may start pulling resources out of Maya and put them into Max, and hopefully slowly get everybody onto Max. The reason I don't think that may happen, or it won't happen anytime soon, is mostly because, you know, there are a lot of the reason people use Maya is because of mail scripting, and mm-hmm. not so much because it exists now. It's because they've already put so much time into mail scripting that they don't want to move to another application because they'd have to rewrite all that customized code. And so
it's the beauty of coming out with a product like Maya did that's so customizable that it locks a facility into a workflow because it's so flexible, and you just sort of find it filling in all the cracks everywhere, and then you can't get off of it.
Yeah, and it's not a great application. You know, Maya is not a great application for an individual user or a particularly small house, in my opinion. Mostly because you almost need the mail scripting to pull it back together and do something useful with it. But for a big house that has lots of developers, it becomes, you know, it's like a little bit of heroin. you can, you know, constantly be customizing it. And so that mail scripting, if anything happens at Autodesk that would risk changing the mail scripting at all, I think that they risk massive hemorrhaging, you know, of their user base. Whereas if a company,
but to where,
what?
To where? That's the problem.
Well, I mean, I think
where do people go?
You know, I think that there's a widely held belief that XSI is actually a superior product as a whole and complete unit than Maya is. It's just that it lost a lot of momentum, you know, being rewritten a couple times.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It was very, very late into the market. There was like a 2 or 3 year window there where they just kind of lost a significant customer base,
yeah,
especially in large facilities.
Yeah, no, and that was their big issue. And so I think that they're working really hard. It looks like XSI is really focusing, or Softimage is really focusing a lot of their tools on character animation. I think that a lot of applications, I think 90% of the applications can do just about all the other stuff fairly well. You know, it's the character animation that really sets them aside, you know, sets them apart, you know, in those big for big facilities, and extensibility, which is something that I still, you know, Maya is still probably one of the best at. You know, of course, the other one that people are kind of watching in the distance is, you know, where, you know, a company like Lexology is going to go, where they don't have all the pieces there, but it's definitely the most modern code base, you know, out there.
And yeah, so. did you go by there? Were they showing any sort of secret previews of beyond their modeling and paint stuff?
Well, they've been showing semi-secret views of the animation stuff for a year now, mm-hmm. and it's crazy.
Yeah,
it's truly frightening to watch what happens when you're not you know, tied down to a to old code. You know, so the that's the thing that's going to be really interesting to see how long it takes them to knock that stuff out, how long it takes them to actually develop that further. The renderer looks great now. 202, you know, 201, you know, had the renderer start to come out. The, you know, now you can do 3D paint, you can do modeling. And we have a lot of members in the Pixel Core that are using Modo for specifically for the modeling and doing some of the 3D paint and starting to render out of it. So those things are all starting to, you know, kind of pick up. And the question is just how long. And I think that, you know, it's going to be hard. The big problem with Modo, I think, is going to be trying to get to move fast enough. You know, right now they have a very modern code base. But right now they need to move faster than they are to kind of take advantage of the window that I think is.
Yeah, and you know, there's so many people that are tied into other systems, like you said. But I don't know what they, you know, what can you do to really start to pull people away? I mean, I don't think that all that many people have gone over to it just for the modeling. So they certainly have to get everything sort of in a piece, and then it's going to be a matter of how do you play the game of price or whatever it takes to get more user base.
Yeah, and I think that there's two levels to it. I think there's this big facilities, but I think that the bigger market, a little further down the pyramid, is a lot of these smaller facilities that are kind of really starting to grow up. I mean, we're not seeing effects movies done by, and we've talked about this before on the show, we're not seeing effects movies done by ILM or Digital Domain by themselves anymore. We're seeing 10, 15, 20 companies working on it, you know, of that may only have 10 or 15 people putting together this kind of stuff, and they're using a wide range of tools, you know. So you're seeing and that's the thing that that I think that we're starting to see happen. We're also seeing more specialization. I mean, you're looking at a you know, where a company like Maxon puts out Cinema 4D, which is not necessarily the high-end character animation tool or anything else, but in broadcast it's, you know, it's been able to penetrate the market very, very effectively for broadcast animation and so on, because they specialized their tools towards that market and made it really easy for them to, you know, to move through that. And so I think that the key is figuring out what specialty are you going for. You know, I think that XSI is moving more towards, if you want to do character animation and that kind of high level piece, that's where they're trying to go. You know, Maya, of course, has extensibility. 3D Studio has games. And then, as I said, I do think that Luxology really needs to have a larger partner, you know, to really help.
Well, that seems like they're ripe for partnering or acquisition or something.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they have the right technology. They just need more scale.
You know, hopefully it's not Autodesk that buys them.
Yeah, I really, really hopefully. So, I mean, Autodesk is, you know, well, I think it's going to be interesting to see how they push all this stuff together. You know, I've seen Autodesk acquire a lot of things. I haven't seen a lot of stuff that I, you know, so far it's still really, really expensive and you know, I guess really leveraging a lot of stuff that I would consider old technology rather than really developing new technology, except for maybe Toxic. So, you know, I'm not sure how successful their model is going to be over time. So
I'll go on the record as saying I think that they're going to end up parking Studio Max.
You think they're going to end up what?
They're going to park it. I think they're going to end of life Studio Max. I think Maya was coming on pretty hard and fast with the gaming stuff.
Really?
And I think that they're worried that with all these major customers that have these, you know, these Mel and Maya dependent production pipelines and code bases, that they're terrified of upsetting those people and losing them to XSI.
Right.
And they think that they can get the game functionality that's traditionally been the strength of Studio Max in Maya. So that's what I think is going to happen. I don't have any inside information. I'm thinking very hard about these things personally right now, and I think that that's what's going to go down.
It's really interesting because, I mean, I think there was an announcement that just went out last week about, you know, ILM has really, you know, they did a press release that they are, you know, they've integrated their IT, you know, for all the way across the system.
Right.
And a lot of that, you know, comes down to, it seems like over time that's going to be really hard to maintain across, because I know that LucasArts still uses a lot of, you know, 3D Studio. But it could be very hard to maintain that if they're, you know, because ILM is such a deep Maya community.
right,
in that area. So I can, and especially as you see that convergence, I can definitely see where you're coming from there.
And you would know. I mean, you were talking a second ago about, you know, how a small facility or a new facility is, they're so much more nimble.
Yeah.
In terms of their ability to you know, address pipelines, to try out new tools. You know, when I was working on LOTR in 97, 98, 99, I can't tell you how many times, you know, new products came up that were clearly superior to products we already had in the pipeline, but they were in the pipeline and working, and it's just difficult or impossible to break a working pipeline.
Right.
You do tend not to even upgrade versions of software whenever you're in the middle of a production, right?
Yeah.
It's when we were, at ILM, I know we were, you know, using very old versions of Softimage because all the code had been written for that.
And because the projects tend to overlap, you're almost never not in production.
Right. Right. Yep.
You know, that's the problem.
And so when you have these little, you know, and I think that there's this, I mean, and I say this a little bit out of, you know, what we're kind of leaning towards when we, as the Pixel Core develops, is really this idea of companies that are constantly forming and almost unforming. You know, I mean, the pipeline is something that's a bit virtual that you're figuring out, and those changes can happen much more rapidly, you know, through the system, you know, as you start to figure that stuff out. Currently, obviously, I think there's eventually going to be some sort of shakeout where we're going to end up with probably three or four, you know, applications that are kind of specialized in their own area, which is, I find, very welcomed. I mean, some of us will remember there was a time when there was like 15 3D applications, and we're now really only talking, I think there's only five or six major players at this point that are significant. So I think that we're slowly kind of shaking out. I think the biggest problem that Autodesk is going to have with either application that they have is just the legacy of the code. You know, they don't. It's an enormous amount of code, and it's, you know, 15 years old. Well, not 15, but at least 10 years old. And that creates, you know, that there's a certain, you know, solidifying of assumption of all the assumptions you made 10 years ago makes it very difficult to make the kind of changes that you really want to make, to make them more interactive. You know, when they were built, no one thought you should do real time performance. You know, no one considered that an option.
Right.
But now when you look at something like Motion Builder, which is owned also by Autodesk now, you know, you're used to working in a project and having heavy polygon number, you know, counts, you know, all playing back in real time. And so, obviously, there's going to be a focus for Autodesk to try to, I think, bring more of that real-time, real-time ability into places like Maya and 3D Studio. But I think it's going to be hard to get all of it actually working.
And to transition and to draw a clear path for their existing customers to move over to it.
Right.
Yeah.
So it'll be a challenge. It'll be interesting.
Enough of those dinosaurs, though.
Anything else cool?
On the new front, I got to see a little of this new application called Mudbox. Have you guys seen any of Mudbox?
I've seen Mudbox.
Looking at the website a little while ago.
It's actually what?
I was looking at the website.
I have seen it. Yeah.
What did you think of it?
I think it's great.
It just for those listening, Mudbox. Essentially, there's another application that has really kind of took the industry by storm, which is a program called ZBrush. And ZBrush essentially allowed you to paint in 3D. And you could start with a sphere and you could kind of move it around. And that was all fine and dandy. I mean, ZBrush has been around for a long time. And first they were just like a little bit of paint 3D, and people would make cool stuff. And then you could start with a sphere or an object. The big change for ZBrush really came when people started to be able to import 3D models. So they'd model a low-res version of something in something like Maya or XSI or something like that, and then they would paint enormous amounts of detail, like really, really fine detail, the kind of stuff that you would normally have with when you're dealing with a clay in ZBrush, and then be able to re-export that out with what we call, you know, with just displacement maps. So you still had your low-res version of the character, or lower-res version, and then you had this displacement map, you know, which displaces the surface and made it look like it had a lot more detail. Or you could just simply paint a lot more actual detail into it. The problem, and a lot of that R&D, and I don't know if you were there, John, during a lot of that stuff, but a lot of that interaction that actually had that occur was happening at Weta.
Correct.
You know, so a lot of the folks that were really pushing the envelope of what you could do with ZBrush were at Weta. They were, you know, working on Lord of the Rings, and they were really pushing that envelope, but they were frustrated with, I mean, ZBrush was kind of built in a completely different interface than, you know, everything else in existence.
Right.
And some people who really love it, love it, but a lot of people, you know, who are used to real 3D applications, you know, that were designed ground up as a 3D application, got really frustrated with it, including some of the guys at Weta, who then went off to create Mudbox, from my understanding.
That's pretty much what happened. Yeah, they had some frustrations. I think ZBrush came into its own really on the second and third films in the LOTR trilogy, and wasn't an enormously useful tool. But as they used it, the guys started to think that there were a few things they'd like to see changed. And I think that they found that the guys from ZBrush were enjoying such amazing success that they were having a hard time, you know, kind of getting their attention. And so they thought, well, we'll just go off and write a different tool, something that meets our needs a little bit more directly.
Yeah, and this is just a much more traditional tool for, I mean, it feels much more like a 3D, I mean, from what I've seen so far. I haven't had a chance to actually put my hands on it and play with it, but from what I've seen from what's on their website, what I saw a little bit at SeaGraph, it's a much more feels like a real tool. You know, ZBrush, you have to kind of rethink how you approach everything. Mudbox is much more straightforward, but has a lot of the same, you know, same advantages.
And wasn't some of the charm of ZBrush that it was kind of different, and in fact, people that weren't necessarily coming from a CG animation kind of background, but more from a traditional sculpting background, found it familiar in some ways that, you know, unlike some of the more core 3D kind of packages.
I think that there was some interest to that, but the people who really, I think that when this really exploded and became commercially, when ZBrush became commercially a big success, I really think it was connected to those CG artists who really just wanted to get work done. You know, I think that was when I seemed to, when I saw it, you know, lots of people would look at it and think it was really, really cool, but a lot of the artists just couldn't get over, like, am I really going to use that enough? So they'd be at Macworld and they'd see ZBrush, and there's nothing like watching a great ZBrush presentation. You know, someone modeling in record time and building objects, and it really is this very organic thing. But there's a lot of, when you actually get to work, there's a lot of limitations about the way you freeze the models, the way you work with the models, the way you import and export them. There's just a lot of things that can be, that are a little difficult because it wasn't really built to do what Weta started using it for, you know, and what people started going, oh, we could do that.
But John, at Weta, did you see traditional artists moving into ZBrush directly or not?
A little bit. You know, I think that there were a few artists. I mean, you know, you sit down 10 modelers and they're going to have skills that vary from, you know, extremely technical to extremely artistic, and certainly a spectrum. And so you would find a more traditional artist attracted to something like ZBrush. And you know, the kind of, at the time, the gee whiz factor of, you know, look what I can do with this thing, and look how quickly I can achieve some things that are, you know, virtually impossible to do in these other packages.
Right.
I think one of the reasons that ZBrush came on so hard and fast is kind of at the same time you were seeing support in hardware for displacement maps, right? You know, so in other words, actually using those things in games, for instance, in real time was becoming practical, and so ZBrush found themselves in a sort of perfect storm of, you know, right now we have, you know, boards that are coming out that can do this thing, that can support this kind of, you know, geometry and these kinds of displacement maps in real time, and here's a tool to manipulate them, you know, more or less directly in an artistic way. And then, you know, the Mudbox guys thought, well, we need things that are integrated a little bit better into our workflow and in the workflow of a larger facility. And I think that's what drove Mudbox.
Yeah, and I think that one of the challenges now for ZBrush or for Pixelogic is that they are a little company, they're a little company that suddenly has an enormous amount of attention, but they also caught the attention of everybody else. And so, you know, I expect to see, you know, more of these kind of tools in everything from Modo to XSI to, you know, all the, you know, and Mudbox. They attracted a lot of attention, and they don't quite have the scale, I think, to, you know, it's just going to be a real challenge. It's not that they can't do it, but it's going to be a real challenge for them to, I think, keep up with the competition, because everybody else is starting, you know, looking at what they like about ZBrush and being able to just implement it, rather than, you know, ZBrush kind of has a certain infrastructure that would take an enormous amount of time to undo if they really wanted to make it more streamlined. So I think that was one of the that's I think a big, you know, challenge for what, you know, what they're dealing with. So anyway,
is Mudbox shipping now? Did they announce
it's in
shipping
public beta?
Public beta. Okay.
So you can go up to their website. It's just mudbox3d.com, and there is a beta sign up. You can ask if you could possibly, maybe, pretty please, you know, get to use their application. And that's about the best you can do right now. But you can see a showcase, which is very impressive. And you know, hopefully we're going to, you know, see more within the fall. But it's, you know, until I get to play with it, I just don't know. But the it looks pretty pretty exciting. It was one of the one of the apps that I was more excited about than a lot of the other ones. So it's it looks really fun. Also, on the hardware end, just to kind of, you know, we were talking about some of the hardware. Did you guys see any of the quadruplex stuff from NVIDIA?
No, it's a lot of hardware.
That's a lot of hardware. It's a John. Did you see? Have you seen any of this stuff with the?
I have not, actually. No.
It's the quadruplex 1000. You know, I guess I'm waiting for the 2000, but. This is four huge graphics boards built into one basically standalone unit. So you now have
it's an outboard graphics card. Yeah.
Yeah. It's you no longer have to worry about being able to shove all those cards and do SLI into your computer. You can just it is doing SLI, which for those of you listening that don't listen to SLI, I don't even know what SLI stands for. Do you guys know what? SLI allows you to basically take two or more, I think up to four cards with NVIDIA, and I think it's very similar to the Crossfire that ATI does, where you're able to use more. If your one graphics board isn't enough, you can now stack graphics boards together so that your Quake engine will run at, you know, 200 frames a second, and
or you can run it on four monitors.
Right, you can run a bunch of monitors. And also, obviously, I think that some of the stuff, I mean, NVIDIA is pointing towards, I think, something that is, for them, I think one of the real limitations for rendering things like Gelato has been you need one graphics card for every computer, which was, I think, a bit annoying for them. And so so I think that a lot of this is also, you know, if you were going to use something like Gelato, you'd probably end up, you know, getting some of these to, as basically a render, you know, a render farm. You know,
and so is this a standalone outboard box with four graphics cards in it?
It looks like a little computer, except it's only got graphics cards in it. It's a little computer full of graphics
full
cards.
Of nothing but graphics cards, yeah.
Can you cook on it?
I'm sorry, what?
You probably can. It does have its own cooling, which
it's
is
gotta, it's got to run pretty warm,
critical.
I bet.
Yeah, no, I think it's, I bet you it's, it definitely looks like it's got a lot of, I haven't seen one, I haven't gotten to really, I mean, I've seen them at, you know, in case at Seagraph, but I haven't actually gotten to touch and play with one yet, so I don't know exactly how warm it gets, but I bet you it does get a fair bit warm. Which, you know, when you look at it, when you actually look at four of these, I mean, I think the price is like, I don't know, it's like $18,000 or $16,000. It's more money than, you know, most of our computers. But when you look at blades, it's not that much more expensive than having four procs. If you were going to render to it, I think that
seems like we're eventually going to get back to the price of the old Silicon Graphics hardware if we keep it up,
except with a lot more power. So,
well, yes,
but yeah, no, it's definitely. I mean, we're definitely moving back that direction. I know that Ron can't say much about this, but I know that with Apple, I felt like this new Mac Pro, which came out the week after, technically after Seagraph. Really represented the first time where I really felt like we were looking at a real workstation again. You know, it was, you know, it's
quick as a bunny.
What?
They're quick as a bunny.
Yeah. So, so they're, you know,
and support for double wide graphic card and, right. And others and stuff like that. So,
well, and the PCI Express, you know, Express stuff. It's just really a real, you know, and you're able to put 16 gigs of RAM in it and two terabytes of storage or up to 3 terabytes if you buy third-party drives, and but it felt like, you know, when I saw it, I just really felt like we were looking at a real workstation again, and we've dealt with a lot of smaller than workstations because we could, but I think that that was anyway, so I think that we're definitely, and now if we get this outboard, of course it doesn't, you know, the Mac Pro doesn't support the quadruplex, but maybe someday. Again, on the software side, did you guys see this photo tourism stuff that Microsoft is doing?
Yeah, it was presented at one of the papers and stuff.
What did you think of it?
It's interesting. I kind of question how practical it is, but it's very sexy. It's they use this they analyze a series of images taken, you know, if you're on vacation somewhere and you're walking around the cathedral and taking pictures of it, and they analyze all these images to basically reconstruct sort of a 3D model of the place you were walking around in, and that becomes your browser where you can sort of choose images you've taken based on the geographic location of where they were shot. You get a little model of the scene.
And it's not really a model. It's really a...
Right.
It's just a collection of... It knows where in 3D all these photos were sitting. Right?
Yeah, although it's more than just photos stacked in 3D space, because it sort of recognizes pieces of photos are at different distances. You know, it doesn't just... It's not just flat photos stuck in space.
Right.
So it's got the sense of, you know, I've taken three shots of this building from three different angles, but I can also see the building behind it, and that shows up in your browser, if you will, as being in a different location.
Right, and it's truly, I mean, it's really sexy to look at. And we'll put a post on the enhanced version of this VFX show here. There's a thing, phototour.cs.washington.edu, that has some of the stuff that's there. And one of the interesting things is that I think that one of the directions that they're kind of going is it's not just your photos. If everybody's uploading these photos and provide some hints of where the photos go, the possibilities of, especially areas that a lot of people go to, is having areas really canvassed. You know, so whole cities could be canvassed and you could be touring through them photographically.
Yeah, and that's what they showed, even, was just some stuff pulled out of a big Flickr data set of certain locations.
Right, and so that's the interesting thing, is it's cool. Not even based on your photos, it's based on everybody's photos.
It can be, yeah.
Or it could be. So it's that was something that I thought, you know, I said it's not so much the 3D and production end of things, but a very, I thought that related to VFX, it only makes it interesting as far as being able to provide... you know, we tend to do a lot of site analysis. So if you're going to do a movie in a specific area, you tend to shoot, you know, you'll send a team there or one person there and shoot hundreds and hundreds of photos. And oftentimes trying to show the director what that actually, what all those photos actually mean about where they can actually shoot. You know, we'll shoot 360-degree panoramas to kind of allow them to build 3D tours. I mean, those are some of the stuff.
Well, yeah, I mean, in general, the pre-visualization aspect of visual effects, but filmmaking in general, has just become huge. And, you know, I mean, it used to be you would only pre-visualize visual effect shots, just get some rough animatic put together in 3D of how the shot's going to work. But these days, you know, as with everything visual effects related, it's all sort of merging into the main line of filmmaking in general. So I can totally see something like this being the location scout can just wander around the different places, just take a lot of photos and not have to think about coming back and building or hiring a 3D modeler to build something. It can just sort of automatically construct that, and then you can start figuring out where your cameras go and do all the previs you need.
Right, and even, I mean, this is one step to that, and I think that there's also another one that I thought was really interesting is that it was interesting to see Google Earth, you know, at Seagraph showing off some of the stuff they're doing. And that's a whole other level of being able to previs is, you know, more and more people are starting to, because of SketchUp and being able to build models very easily and then import them into Google Earth, being able to, you know, build out entire 3D cities is becoming much more, you know, straightforward and allowing a lot of that stuff to actually work.
So. There's a lot of, you know, this came from the photography aspect, and there was a lot of really good stuff that's, you know, photography really. I mean, it's nice because the accessibility of digital cameras now is such that I think so many people can get them. You're seeing tons of research going on that's sort of, you know, ostensibly still photography related, but of course all of that ends up making its way over to, you know, moving imagery, at least a lot of it does, pretty quickly.
Right.
So there's really great stuff with, I mean, everything from refocusing some out of focus images using a couple of different technologies to
did you go to that paper actually on the refocusing?
Yeah.
What did you think of it?
It's cool.
How does it work?
I mean, well, of course the stuff they showed worked pretty well.
but how does it work? I've
seen a lot of software demos too. Well, it's a couple of things. There's Well, first of all, like I said, you know, there's two kinds of out of focus images that you can tend to get. One is if you're just change your focus incorrectly, and you know the whole image is out of focus. But what they were concentrating on was more the issue that happens when you're doing still photography of your you can't hold your camera perfectly steady. So it's out of focus in the sense that really you're getting motion blur on it,
mm-hmm.
And there have been tools out there that can kind of reconstruct images. They call it deconvolve an image to try to get it back in focus based on sort of figuring out what defocus kernel, if you will, was used for that. And I know like there's a plugin for from the Foundry, the guys that do the Furnace plugins. On some high-end compositing apps, it will do a certain amount of de-blurring of an image using the same kind of thing, but it's more of the overall out-of-focus stuff. Where and it tends to work best with for motion blur stuff if it's a fairly linear camera move. I mean, the example that they always show is one where the camera's sort of panning in a fairly consistent fashion, and you get images motion blurred based on that. But the thing that these guys were talking about in the paper they presented that was really pretty clever is if you've got something where you held your camera up and you took a picture and your hand was unsteady and that caused it to be out of focus, you can find clues in the image, and one they used most common was like a highlight caught in somebody's eye that sort of will give you a little path, an indication of the path that the camera took as it was moving. So if you look real close at a picture that was handheld, you can see that the little highlight, specular highlight in the eye is, you know, carves out some particular little shape. And they analyze that in some fashion to try and figure out what the camera did.
Yeah, a lot of the results look pretty impressive, you know, from what they had. But of course, everything looks impressive when you have test results that were designed to...
Yeah.
Out of the 60,
it is a demo.
Yeah. Out of the 60 pictures they took, these four worked really, really well. So,
but the impressive thing is that it, you know, what they showed too was images that were fairly out of focus, that were, you know, pretty bad, and you know, in the professional visual effects world in particular, the shots you tend to fix are ones where it's not that bad. It tends to be shots where okay, they missed focus just a little bit, or there's some particular problem,
right?
And so I can totally see this kind of stuff working actually quite well in a just a standard visual effects environment.
Well, I know there was a lot of fixes when I was working on SW1. There was a lot of subtle fixes that were made to a lot of stuff that was slightly out of focus. I'm not sure what the techniques were that were used, but there was a lot of there's a whole group of shots from the movie that needed to be corrected.
Yeah, well, I know I've had to fix shots where, you know, focus comes in and out. You see it with Steadicam stuff a lot.
Right.
And a lot of times you'll just grab a frame that's in focus and kind of track it back in to kind of bridge the gap where it gets out of focus,
right,
and things like that. But, you know, the artifact that shows up by using these kind of refocusing algorithms is that it tends to introduce a little bit of additional grain into the image, a little bit of noise.
Right.
When you get it back there, but again, it may be something that other tools can help compensate. So
and you just got to decide which one is worse, you know, the blur,
yes,
or the grain. I mean, that's always the. Usually, people are happier with seeing it'll be a little grainier than having to be a little blurry.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, but anything else? Did you see anything else that was particularly jumped out at you at Seagraph?
High dynamic range is everywhere these days.
Yeah, it was funny. You know, I think probably 4 or 5 years ago, I mean, when we started doing R&D on HDR, I mean, when we saw the first stuff from Paul Dubevic and thought we would, you know, let's get ahead of this, you know, and no one had heard about it, and no one knew how to use it, and everything else, and now it's just part of the infrastructure now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is. I mean, the limiting factor is still it's a pain in the ass to capture HDR images. But,
now, don't we think that? I mean, I always think that eventually we're going to see still cameras that are just...
I'm pretty surprised that they have not advanced as quickly as a lot of the other technology has. I got to believe that at some point, relatively soon, one of the big sensor manufacturers, you know, Sony or Canon or somebody, is going to come out with something that's going to be relatively breakthrough.
I mean, I think that the algorithm is simple enough that it's one of those things that it seems to me like I could just, you know, you could do it in the hardware of the camera where it's essentially, mm-hmm, doing what I'm doing later, which is that I'm going to fire off a shot, I'm going to fire a bunch of exposures really close to each other, and then, mm-hmm, I'm going to compile them into an HDR, and I'm not going to, you know, I'm just going to do it. You know, so
yeah.
I can say I want to build an HDR sort of 10 the... exposures. Mm-hmm. And just let it and the camera just, because my 20D will shoot all of those images inside of a, you know, 2 or 3 seconds.
Right, which is, but still, if it's really moving footage, that's not fast enough, and you're gonna have to get something where you can shoot off at pretty high speeds to be able to capture stuff. But yeah, I think that is a potential solution, and that, and coupled with sort of the optical flow technologies that can put stuff back together.
Right, and even if it's almost like a combination of the, you know, like I don't know, we did some tests, or not we didn't do some tests, but one of our members did some tests with the Photron. I think it's the Photron camera.
High-speed camera, yeah.
And 800 frames a second is exciting.
Yeah, and at that point, that is fast enough to capture HDR stuff and do it. I mean, another idea that I had that I will throw out there for somebody to get rich off of is if you're shooting stereo stuff, and everybody's going to be shooting stereo stuff soon enough, I kind of have to believe that if you shot, you know, your left eye overexposed by a couple stops and your right eye underexposed by a couple of stops, there's plenty of information that can be pulled out of that using a little bit of optical flow to reconstruct something that's, you know, still gives you a good stereo pair,
right,
but also gives you HDR.
Well, that'd be interesting.
So somebody go do that.
Okay.
Because it's easy.
And send us an email. We'll talk about it on the show. We'll show it on the show.
Absolutely.
Anything else?
What were the other fun stuff?
I think that the one thing, I guess the big seminar that everyone talked about, actually, that I talked to, was really not actually in the papers, but was actually the ILM presentation that John Knoll did on pirates. You know,
yeah, that was great. I just happened to be walking by the booth when he was doing it, and it was really good presentation. That's the kind of thing where you wish that could get packaged up somewhere and available to a lot of people.
Yeah, it was really. I mean, it's just, yeah, it's it. What's amazing is I think that one of the things that became clear watching it was that ILM is really, you know, big companies like ILM are focusing on basically being able to tell a director who has got a big budget that you can do anything. Just, mm-hmm. you know, we're no longer going to be on set telling you can't move the camera, you can't do this, you need to worry about this, we need markers over here. I mean, they were really just like, you know, just shoot.
Well, and I think, I mean, the point that really was driven home for me, too, when I looked at more of the making of stuff on that is sort of where the technology is for motion capture. And,
yeah.
You know, I've seen some of the stuff that Sony's done with Polar Express and Monster House, which just came out recently, which uses a really dense array of sensors, particularly on the face, mm-hmm. to capture the facial movement. And you look at the stuff that ILM used, which is pretty sparse in terms of the witness points that they would put on the characters' faces. And it looks fantastic.
Well, but I think that ILM definitely focuses pretty heavily on. I don't think that they're. I mean, I could be wrong, but ILM, I know in the past, has focused very heavily on hand animation of facial animation.
Well, and that's my point is that I think that having a good animator in conjunction with not nearly as heavy a data set is still getting better results, and I have to believe faster results than some of the stuff that is just really heavy data acquisition, and then you spend, you know, God knows how many days or weeks or months trying to parse all that data into something that's actually human usable.
Well, and I think that one of the only other one that was interesting in that area was dealing with, there was a company called Mova. Did you, I don't know if you saw that, where they put I believe it's UV, either UV aware or ultraviolet aware, kind of a green or a paint on your face.
It's that system, the contour system.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so what it's doing is instead of trying to figure out where all those markers are, you're just kind of gooping this stuff on, and it just takes that. It's just basically my guess is, and they're here in San Francisco, so I'm going to hopefully go and kind of get a closer look at it. That it just grabs a whole bunch of points. It's kind of like doing an auto track, you know.
It's more of an optical flow kind of thing. The same thing you use for analyzing a full image instead of individual tracking points. It really is that equivalent for facial tracking, where, you know, you put this stuff on that I guess is UV fluorescence, and it gives you a pattern enough that you can sort of analyze the entire image as a pattern as opposed to individual witness points.
Yeah, and I think that, it looked like an exciting technology. I get the impression that it produces an enormous amount of data at the moment.
It looked to me like there was actually an article in the New York Times about it, I think on the first or second day of the conference, and just from the photographs, it looked to me like the rig was pretty substantial and wasn't going to be that mobile, like that the actors themselves might actually be seated in a chair doing facial mocap. I'm not sure if that's true, and I'm not sure if it is true, if that's useful.
Well, I think it's useful for some things. It just like for something like Monster House, it might be useful. For something like Pirates, the way they were shooting it, it wouldn't be. You know, it would be. I mean, a lot of what. I mean, what was amazing when you look at some of the Pirate stuff is that all that stuff was being shot on set with basically three cameras. You had the main film camera, and then two helper cameras, and that were basically triangulating all the stuff. And so they were really using a lot of rigid bodies and really controlling where, you know, knowing where the body can go and making a lot of decisions around that. And we're going to actually do some R&D in the Pixel Core in September, so hopefully we'll be able to have some stuff that we can talk about. Because there's one company called, you know, one RealViz, you know, has a motion capture system that's kind of I don't think at the same level of what ILM was doing, but it is doing a lot of the similar things where if you give it a couple helper cameras and you have a main camera, you can, get motion capture data out of it. It doesn't work to, you know, it's not like all the motion capture and you could do big, really complex things, but for a typical actor moving down, you know, walking down the stairs or doing stuff, the data was really impressive.
Are you talking facial mocap or body mocap?
This was body motion capture.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, so we've done facial motion capture with the RealViz software already, and it's been really successful. So, but we just used three DV cameras that we lined up, and we had a calibrated backing, and you know a lot of stuff. You know, and right now what they're telling us is that we don't need any of that anymore, at least for the body motion capture. And so we're gonna kind of take that to the test in September. We're going to, we have a F950 here, so we're going to use the F950 as the main camera and two DV cameras as helper cameras and see what kind of data we really get. So it definitely got me more excited about it, seeing what ILM was doing.
I should also say, going back to the Pirates a little bit, I had a chance to talk to John, mm-hmm. who, and I want to not, if not retract, at least modify a statement I made when we were doing the
Black Levels, Black Levels.
I'm not backpedaling. But what I said, and John was right for giving me crap about saying it in this way, was that there was a couple shots where I wasn't sure if the black levels were quite matching, and it really probably was an incorrect use of the term. For those that aren't totally familiar with all the syntax, usually when you're talking about black levels is making sure that the blackest blacks in the scene are all synchronized and consistent, between the background plate and the new stuff that you're putting on, and it's sort of almost an amateur's mistake, I guess I have to say, to not look into those darks and make sure they're synchronized, and so I can certainly understand why when I said black levels, John wasn't pleased to hear that. So I'll modify my statement to say that I'm not going to say the shots are suddenly perfect now, but I will modify my statement to be that really what I think I was reacting to was in some of the scenes where the Kraken was put over the ship. There were places where some of the atmosphere that was laid back on top of it didn't feel like it was maybe quite dense enough. Uh-huh. And it's a subtle distinction, but it is actually a distinction, and it's not really black levels so much as, you know, when you're integrating some CG elements into the midst of something. And I mean, John shoots all this stuff with real atmospheric effects happening on set, you know, the smoke
and
the debris.
It was just insane. I mean, because I had a chance to talk to him a little bit too, and it was just insane to look at what they were doing, where they just really, because John really pointed out something that was really important, which was that we're going to get John in trouble here by saying, "Oh, we talked to John and he said this." But but the one thing that was interesting was that how much he was talking about how much atmospheric conditions, you know, when you're dealing with that smoke, you'd want to put that in as a separate element, but that changes the entire fill light of what's going on the set.
Yeah, you know, so, and I can certainly understand the reasons, you know, why you'd want to shoot everything, having the atmosphere on set, but it makes it crazy difficult for the compositors then to try and put this stuff, you know, you can't just say, all right, I want to put this element behind all of this debris and smoke and stuff. I mean, it's a incredible balancing act of then trying to simulate the effects of all this additional atmosphere on top of the elements that are being put in there.
Well, and I think that one of the things that is, you know, as I said, what I was already fairly impressed with what Pirates, you know, obviously we had talked about that in the past. I was more impressed after I saw what had happened, because you also looked at some of these roto shots. I mean, there's a roto shot of the guy running across the bridge that they show in the presentation, and they just changed the entire background. And I mean, and it's like the roto. It's just that's just you know. For those of you, you know, rotoscoping, of course, is drawing little lines around little people every single frame. And you've got a moving camera and a person running into a complex background. That is like, that's a very unhappy experience for somebody. I mean, that's like 6 weeks of someone's life, you know, for that 3 seconds to get that done. And I just expected that that was some kind, either that was mostly live action or it was all blue screen or whatever. I mean, it looked seamless when I saw it. I have to admit, I didn't even consider it an effect shot. When I saw it, until I saw what they had done, you know, and it was pretty impressive. So, and the one thing that I did find out is that, you know, the one shot that we kind of clumped onto, that I know I clumped onto as far as compositing,
that was the towards the end shot,
yeah, where Johnny Depp is in front of the Kraken,
right?
So there was some kind of plate change, you know, with, you know, 48 hours to go. So that was the 1 week point. And it sounds like, I mean, when John showed his presentation, it really was amazing to look at the production pipe of how many shots were getting done per week and what they had to ramp up to actually finish it. So it's
I'm looking forward to the third one.
Yeah. No, I think it's I know actually a lot of people both on the set actually doing stunts and other stuff like that on it right now, and also people working on post, and it just sounds like it's going to be bigger, which it's hard to imagine, but it should be pretty nifty. So I think we've run this one all the way into the ground.
I think so.
Good for us.
What'd you say?
I said good for us.
Yeah, exactly. So I think we've taken this one as far as it's going to go. I didn't know if we'd have enough to talk about, and apparently we did. So anyway, from Hermosa Beach, John LaBrie and Ron Brinkman, thanks for coming in, guys.
Thank you.
Always happy.
Good.
And what do we want people to do?
Until next time,
keep it real.
Keep it real.